Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm joined today by Lincoln Chafee, the governor of Rhode Island. Governor Chafee was elected to his position in 2010 as an independent, having left the Republican Party following a re-election defeat for the U.S. Senate in 2006. In 2013, he became a Democrat. Prior to serving in the Senate, Governor Chafee served on the Warwick City Council and as that city's mayor. Governor Chafee, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Grant. Thank you for inviting me.
You've been at the center of some big discussions about politics in America, about the polarization between the parties and the level of conflict and nastiness involved there. You came from a long line of prominent Republicans. You were known as a centrist, a moderate, even perhaps a liberal Republican. You then left the party, won the governor's seat as an independent. Now you're a Democrat. So I want to explore all that a little bit with you. First, when did you first feel that there was a serious tension between you and the Republican Party?
I think when my dad was sharing with me as a member of the United States Senate, as a Republican, after the election of 1994, and he was chairman of the Environment Public Works Committee, and there was some tension with the incoming new Republicans that came over from the House, Republicans that come over from the House into the Senate in that 94 seismic Gingrich revolution. And they were questioning his positions and maybe even threatening to take away his chairmanship of his committee. And I can remember him saying, just expressing frustrations with my long service to this party. How could they possibly question my integrity and how I feel about these issues and my commitment to the party after these many decades? And just frustration with these new fire-breathing Republicans.
And what about for you as a political figure and the issues there? Were there in particular any issues that really became to be big problems for you in the Republican Party?
My dad died in office in 1999, late in 1999, and I was appointed to his seat. So I served for a year under President Clinton, and I could feel it then as we came into the year 2000, an election year, and President Clinton's last year. Trent Lott and Tom Daschle and the battles that were going on and the strictly party line votes so often. A small group of moderates, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, Jim Jeffords, Arlen Specter, and myself would swing back and forth. A few Democrats occasionally, John Breaux, Ben Nelson would vote with Republicans. But there were precious few. There were a lot of party line votes.
And my understanding is that you were the only Republican in the Senate to vote against the war in Iraq. Is that correct?
Well, I started out even that year with Bill Clinton voting for raising the minimum wage. We had votes that the Republicans didn't want on prescription drug benefits. We had votes on some gun safety issues. And so I was a little bit out of step right off the bat with the Republican majority. And then Bush and Cheney got elected, and it was the big tax cuts, which I voted against. John McCain and I were the only Republicans to vote ultimately in the final vote against those big tax cuts. And then some environmental issues that I opposed the president. But then finally the war in Iraq was the big one.
Tell me a little bit about that, the decision there and what you went through.
Well, I think really just to back up the tax cuts, I mean, that was the really before September 11th. That was the first real battle. It was huge, huge tax cuts that favored the wealthy and made no sense because we'd fought so hard to get surpluses over decades, finally achieved them. And here came in a $1.5 trillion tax cut that favored the wealthy. And so I lost my faith in the president and the vice president's decision-making then. I questioned them right from the beginning of what their agenda was, especially since it was so different from what they'd campaigned on. And so when the march to war in Iraq came and the premise that there was weapons of mass destruction, I just didn't believe it. I'd come not to believe what they said. And I just never saw the evidence that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. In fact, I went down to the CIA and I said, I have to vote on this. Can you show me everything you have that might show there's weapons of mass destruction before I go in and vote? I don't believe them. I haven't seen the evidence, but maybe you can convince me. And there were about 20 analysts at a table, and they showed me satellite pictures and different maps and things, and it was just totally unconvincing. And I was the only one. I had no staff. I was just alone, and I didn't want to embarrass myself and show my ignorance of what I was looking at. But what I noticed more than anything was those 20 CIA analysts. It wasn't really any directors or anything like that, but they were the analysts. It was their body language where they weren't going, Senator, you've got to see. This is absolutely convincing chemical weapons lab. It's there was none of that. You got to see this missile launching site or it just wasn't that. They unrolled the maps and they stood back. And so I said, they don't even believe this to myself. And then finally they handed me an aluminum tube that was supposed to centrifuge or uranium or that, there was something about uranium and the aluminum tubes. And I'm looking at it thinking I could buy this down at Mancini's Hardware in North Kingstown. So if there was another premise to go to war, I would be willing to listen to it. But I didn't believe that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. I was right in the end.
And I'm very curious if you could share this, what the discussions in the caucus might have been like over this. I imagine, I mean, you're the only one who's going to vote against it. Did you speak in the caucus? What was the reaction there?
I came back from that CIA meeting, and we had a Thursday lunch of Republicans, and I remember standing up and saying I'd been to the CIA, and I was totally unconvinced, and people just weren't listening. They had good relationships with my fellow Republican senators, and usually they listened, but on this one, their minds were made up, and I remember Mike DeWine from Ohio saying to me, Link, you're right, but everybody's mind is made up. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just political. They knew the people were angry. They knew the people were scared, too dangerous emotions. And we were not making good decisions. We just finished with Vietnam, with all the veterans that were finally dealing with all their veterans' issues that come back from Vietnam. And so we had to be very careful about these kinds of foreign interventions, I thought.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee. So what finally pushed you over in the end to actually turn in your Republican membership card?
Well, it was I was caught because I was increasingly getting disenfranchised and disaffiliated with the agenda of the Republican Party in the environmental issues, fiscal issues, foreign intervention issues. But I was in the majority party as a senator. The president won re-election in 2004. We had a Republican Senate, a Republican House. I was in a position to deliver for Rhode Island, being in the majority. If I left the party, my state would be penalized. We wouldn't get any federal aid. The military bases would suffer. The highway bill, which we were debating at the time, huge, billions and hundreds of billions of dollars. In Rhode Island would get nothing. So I was kind of caught. I had to look out for my state. And finally, when I did not succeed in my reelection, I very quietly went down to my local board of canvassers and disaffiliated and became an independent.
Now, let me fast forward a bit. You became an independent, but I want to shift to the decision to join the Democrats in 2013. You joined the Democrats in 2013. What prompted that decision?
I found governing as an independent harder than I thought. I know Angus King and Jesse Ventura have had success at it in Maine and Minnesota. I found it very, very hard. The economy was tough in Rhode Island. People were stressed out, and small issues became big issues. And I had no political party that had my back during some of these tough times. And so I thought, should I join the Libertarians or join the Greens or what are my options? I knew I didn't want to go back to being a Republican. And I made the decision to become a Democrat and was very happy. I think that the tradition of standing up for the middle class is really the key issue that I'm proud to be a Democrat about. For all my memory, that's been a Democratic issue.
And with all the polarization that exists in the national political climate right now, I'm very curious to know, have prominent Democrats around the country and in the state, have they embraced you for this? I would think that perhaps, again, that polarization might make them a little suspicious of this on your part.
Maybe I waited too long in that as other Democrats naturally wanted to run for governor of Rhode Island, some interpreted this as politically expedient. But I thought long and hard about where I wanted to find a home, as I mentioned, other political parties and that didn't seem to fit. And so this was, I think, in my long-term political best interest. I know other members of my family have become Democrats, so it's, I think, something my dad also would completely understand and support.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee. His prior political positions include the United States Senate and the Warwick City Mayor. I want to come back to this problem of polarization and just the level of nastiness and dysfunction that we seem to see between the parties in Washington. What's driving it at the end of the day, do you think?
We talked earlier about Rush Limbaugh and talk radio, and you could add to that Fox News and just the divide between what people are reading and listening to, I think, and watching. And that certainly is a factor. You have this polarization in the media as well. And then, of course, many of the experts have talked about the primaries, and I saw it firsthand. I know the main senators were always worried about primaries. I had one myself in 2006. I won it from a candidate funded by the Club for Growth anti-tax group that funneled millions of dollars into various races and particularly into Rhode Island.
This is back when you were Republican getting challenged from the right.
That's
correct?
Right. Yeah. That's right. Here I was in a very blue state, if not the most Democratic state in the country, trying to hold on to a Republican seat. And I get primaried by a right-wing Club for Growth Republican that had no chance in the general. Absolutely zero chance. It made no sense just practically to challenge me, but it's just for ideological purity. And so these are the primaries drag the candidates to the fringes, especially on the Republican side with the Tea Party, the media. So it's a combination of factors, and certainly gerrymandering of districts, people safe in their districts. There should be some overlap of red and blue in some of these districts to so the candidates more talk about issues that are central to both sides, education and health care and jobs.
How do these things play out inside the state of Rhode Island? Do you see the same kind of level of nastiness and polarization, or things a little better inside the state?
No, my term as governor, we've had these, what is I call them, small issues turn into big issues. Getting illegal immigrants in Rhode Island to have in-state tuition, to me, it made just complete sense to have these youngsters that are here to finish high school, because they're not going to finish high school if they can't afford to go to college, I don't think, and then to get into URI or Rhode Island College or Community College of Rhode Island with in-state tuition. If they can't afford the out-of-state tuition, that's not in our best interest as a society to have uneducated youngsters out there. But that became a huge issue with massive protests, and certainly I was involved in a capital punishment case. I repeatedly said throughout my political career I'm opposed to capital punishment, and that's a policy that you can question me on, but that's how I was elected, and that became a big issue. So a Christmas tree, all of a sudden a war on Christmas. I mean, that's not why I got into public service.
You were calling it a holiday tree, right?
Yeah, my predecessor called it a holiday tree. I just, when time came to celebrate the holidays, I said, do what they did last year. Don't spend any more, don't spend any less, and do what they did. And for some reason, it boomeranged back on me. So I've seen this partisan kind of anger erupt in Rhode Island.
Is there anything as governor that you've tried to do to engender more cross-party collaboration, things that you've done with the State House or with the communities?
When I first got elected, I worked very, very hard to have a bipartisan administration, have former office holders from the Democratic Party in my administration. I have candidates that ran for Republican in my administration. It was everybody saying, wow, you've reached across all political lines in forming a team. So I made every effort possible, I thought, to say, let's focus on the job at hand, getting our economy going, dealing with the issues that affect Rhode Islanders together. The election's over, and when it's time to have an election, we'll go at it hammer and tongs. But right now, let's focus on getting the job done. And I'm willing to do it with anybody.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee. I want to pursue this just a little bit more. I'm on the email list for both of the main national parties, and each of them seems to devote most of its time to telling me why the other side is bad, sometimes even evil, the way they describe it. So what will it take at the national level to generate more cross-party work and more function versus dysfunction? What will it take?
Well, that's the question we're all asking, and we talked about a little bit earlier these primaries and the gerrymandering of districts, safe house districts, the perpetual campaigns, as you're getting mailings continually from both sides, the quest to raise money, especially after Citizens United. Everybody's out there fundraising 24/7. But ultimately, I have faith in the American people to sift through all the noise and make good decisions. We're kind of at a moment here where this partisanship just seems to go on without end. But we've got to get weary of this. And there's so many challenges we have in this country. And get back to our stature as a world leader in so many ways. And we just have to get that back and put this petty differences aside. And, or bring them up in campaigns during the time when they when the battle rages for – but now it's perpetual. If the citizens demanded their elected officials, once the election's over, focus on the job at hand, put the partisan political rhetoric aside, and then when the campaign comes, we'll listen to you.
Well, that was actually – you touched on that last point I wanted to ask you about. There's two things that sometimes I hear as possible ways this thing might get fixed. One is the one that you mentioned, which is if voters start really seriously holding candidates accountable for the way that they campaign in addition to the positions that they're holding. And the other one is if one of these two parties just gets a big boost or a big electoral shock – big enough to sort of get them to say, wait a minute, we need to rethink all this.
Yes, I thought that that was going to happen to the Republican Party back in 2000 when I won my race for the Senate. The Republicans lost a number of seats, and in the end, the Senate was 50-50. And I thought, boy, the voters have spoken. Olympia Snow won, Jim Jeffords won, Link Chafee won, the moderates won their races. But a number, John Ashcroft lost, Bill Roth lost, a number of Republicans lost in that 2000 election. So here's a message. Maybe we'll change. And then, of course, September 11th happened and things changed. And then the Republicans got more seats in 2002 and the president won re-election and got more seats in 2004. And then after the economy cratered and Barack Obama, Senator Obama got elected president, I thought, wow, maybe now the Republicans will start rethinking. But they bounced back in 2000, even in 2009, that quickly. Even with all the bad tax policies that brought back the deficits, the failed war in Iraq, back they came with winning Virginia. The Republicans won Virginia. They won New Jersey in that off year. And then they won Scott Brown's race for Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts all in that off year. It turned so fast back to the Republicans, and of course, in 2010, winning the House. But President Obama won re-election, so ease the momentum. I think as we look ahead for the Republicans, I think as we look ahead in 2014, that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, being a prime issue for the Republicans, I think it's a good one to have a big national debate on and good for the Democrats, ultimately. I know it had a tough rollout, but people do want health care, affordable health care, and they don't want to have to go to the emergency room and wait 5 hours for primary care. And I think the Democrats are going to win on this issue.
Now, another thing that gets talked about in this vein is the effect of money on politics. And almost every elected politician will say, well, money's a problem, but it doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect what I do. So let me ask you this. What is the nature of the influence of money? Does it matter? Did it matter
for
you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's time consuming. It's without a doubt, it affects your voting, who's contributing to you. It just naturally does. And with Citizens United now and independent expenditures and the fear that this money is going to infiltrate not into the big Senate races and House races and governor's races, but down into local races is of concern. Yeah, but once again, you have to have faith in the voters and to sift through all this and be suspicious of large amounts of money that are being spent. Where is it coming from? And almost a reverse of there's so much money being spent. Where is this coming from? What kind of dark money is involved here? And just be wary and suspicious of the tremendous amounts of money that's going to be spent coming up in these races.
You mentioned a bit earlier the concern for the middle class. And you have spoken about the growing economic inequality in the United States, challenges faced by both the poor and the middle class. I wanted to mention that there was a recent study of United States policymaking by a couple of researchers, one at Princeton, one at Northwestern, that's getting a bit of press lately. And it has argued that the United States really is no longer a democracy. It's actually more like an oligarchy. And what these two researchers have done have looked at the public opinion polls about certain policies and contrasted them with the positions taken by powerful interests, and then looked at the policy outcomes. And they've found that over the last 20 years or the 20-year period that they looked at in recent history, that it's really no contest. The popular position is not the one that manifests itself in policy outcomes. So do you think that they're right? Is the United States now an oligarchy?
Who's spending the most money wins. And I think what's going to contest that premise is that the young people are going to get involved more in elections. The millennials, this generation, is really tuning in to what's happening. They're personally affected. I think they concern themselves if coming out of school, finding it difficult to find jobs, watching the chaos that has happened in the last number of years with the economy. And want to look at the issues. And I know growing up that the young people back in the 60s and 70s, the effect they had on elections, I think that might happen again. The new generation, I'm very proud of what they're thinking, and they're analyzing and looking through all the social media and trying to sift through some of the noise out there.
Do you think that the middle class and the poor are right to be angry about things in this country today?
I don't think they're angry enough. You just see how well the wealthy are doing. And nonetheless, the middle class, too many of them are tuning into Fox News and supporting some of these Republican programs that favor the wealthy. So I wish that the middle class was saying, this isn't working for me, these Republican policies. We tried them, trickle down, or whatever you want to call it. All these tax cuts, they just don't work. No politician wants taxes, but we want social programs to grow the middle class. And I like in particular to look at education, whether it's Pell Grants. Pell Grants worked. It's not just the wealthy that can go to college. Everybody can go out. Anybody can go out and get a Pell Grant if you qualify for it and go on and get a higher education. That was fabulous social programs started by Senator Pell from Rhode Island, I'll note. And then, of course, Head Start. Why should the wealthy go to pre-K and learn the alphabet and a little bit how to read and get a head start? Now, the Head Start program, great social program, a federal program that helped build the middle class. And that, so that's the argument us Democrats have to make to the voters, and particularly the middle class. These are beneficial social programs. The federal government can, or all governments, can be a force for good in your lives. And we'll be careful of all your tax dollars and not wasteful, but there are programs that work.
We'll have to leave it there, but we'll pick up the conversation next week. That was Lincoln Chafee. Again, I'll continue my conversation with him next week when we look more closely at his time as governor. Governor Chafee, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Research assistance was provided by Brooke Weinstein. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. Visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations for more information.